harping on the wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in a fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in a fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And, of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, tomorrow morning, that would be Tuesday morning, the 27th of August, at 10 o'clock in Ontario Superior Court at 361 University Avenue, Dr. James Sears will appear for a bail hearing. He is, of course, a political prisoner jailed last Thursday for the nonviolent expression of his political views in the as editor of Your Ward News, and particularly for satire, poking fun at some of the sacred cows, the new religion of Holocaust. He questioned that with in humor. Questioned the LGBT agenda, particularly the radical feminist agenda. Well, you know, that is not what they wanted to have. And in politically correct Canada, you sometimes have to pay the price. So he's going to be seeking bail. We certainly hope that that's what he will get. And so if you are in Toronto and can attend at 10 o'clock, and that's at the Ontario Superior Court at the courthouse at 361 University Avenue in Toronto, probably courtroom 206, but you're going to ask at the front desk. Now, in another related matter, the pathetic Patterson Outdoor Signs branch of the huge Patterson conglomerate yesterday announced that it was canceling taking down billboards bought by a third party to promote Maxime Bernier's People's Party of Canada and The sign very simply said, cut immigration. Well, apparently an online petition gained 11,000 signatures, which is really not all that much, frankly. But that somehow spooked the cowards at the Patterson outdoor signs, and they've canceled the contract, and their pictures today, it is so pathetic. It is so pathetic and sad. Their workers tearing down the heavy paper that makes up one of these big billboards. Absolute censorship. Now it gets, if possible, even more worse, because it turns out that Patterson Outdoor Signs is huge, and it has 55% of the market in Canada. So it isn't even quite as easy as, well, if Patterson turns you down, you can go to the provider next door. And it may be possible, but that's not always going to be the case. So if it was a situation with I won't say quite a monopoly, but near monopoly. It's not quite like a fast food place. So if McDonald's won't serve you for some reason, maybe Harvey's or A&W or some other company can. Not quite like that. And I have been making this point before, but it's one that I think we have to be very insistent on, and that is that their day will come, and these corporate traitors, and they are traitors to freedom of speech. I would say probably they aren't even operating in their own self-interest. Because when you have 55% of the market, frankly, people who are like me who are upset with them, where are we going to go? Well, there may be alternatives, but maybe not. And this is really a very sinister and powerful position that these people have, and they've abused it. And I think the day will come, hopefully, when these times pass and another ethos takes over, that these soulless companies that so betray freedom will to some extent have their freedoms curbed. I would hope that the laws could be changed so that they could be sued for this, so that they could be sued for a breach of contract, and that may well be possible. Or sued for the interference in the electoral process. They are party to the suppression of a point of view. Now, they weren't asked to provide access free of charge. They didn't know. A major backer, Maxime Bernier, put up something like $60,000 for a series of these billboards across Canada and Edmonton and Calgary. I believe in Vancouver, in Toronto, in Halifax, in Quebec City. They're not being asked to sacrifice anything. They're asked simply to provide the space, if they have it, to advertise in an election. And this is interfering in the election process. Is it just blind cowardice? It could be. But we do know that there are some in corporate Canada who are 100% on track with the immigration program. And the immigration program is massive importation of cheap labor from the third world, which keeps unemployment high and wages low. That serves the very selfish short-term purpose of some companies. Now, I think it should be the role of the Dominion government not to permit that. Yes, it's perfectly legitimate for companies to operate in their own best interest. That's understandable. But where that interest conflicts with the national interest, it's not in the national interest to have basically slave labor or very low wage labor. That's not good for us. Maybe good short term for some companies, but it's not good for a nation. Well, they've collaborated in that, or at least a number of businesses have, and for several generations. And that is despite the fact that it's going that the immigration patterns, 85% from the third world each year, and very, very large numbers of immigration, are changing the demography of Canada. So that by 2050, the European founding settler people will be a minority. This is immigration, an immigration policy of ethnic replacement. Now, whether they look upon these businesses, look upon it as simply cheap labor, and they don't care where it comes from. It could come from Burundi, the Sudan. They don't care as long as it's cheap. And I think that I've seen that with the meatpacking industry. And there are gaps in our knowledge. Well, when big companies with abattoirs like in Brandon, Manitoba, seem to have large numbers of people from the Sudan, and you wonder, well, what special talent do people from the Sudan have when it comes to chopping up an animal's carcass into steaks and roast beef and so on? Well, I don't know, and I rather doubt they have a particular talent. Is it that there are special government subsidies? Well, we haven't been able to prove that one way or another. But it is cheap labor, and that seems to be what appeals to these companies. Now, cheap labor may be good for them. Cheap labor that changes our demography is not good for us. As I've suggested, their day will come. Now, exactly how they can be punished, we're going to have to think more carefully. I'm not for illegal measures, but I am for changing the environment so that they suffer for what they've done to suppress patriotic Canadians and free speech. Here's a very excellent write-up by Michael Hoffman II, who wrote a book on the first Zundel trial, called just that, the Zundel trial. And this is an essay just put out called The Karmic Consequences of Heresy Hunting. Oozing with aristocratic entitlement and indignation, the legacy media are whining, or we might call it the lamestream media, the legacy media are whining about the insolence of writers and broadcasts who have the effrontery to investigate the skeletons in their closet. Oh, now there's a good one. Former reporter for the New York Bureau of the Associated Press, on the front page of the August 25th edition of the New York Times, two reporters, Kenneth P. Vogel and Jeremy W. Peters, decry a new movement by right-wing researchers among Donald Trump's base aimed at sleuthing into the background and statements of journalists in the employ of the legacy media. These investigations have been declared to be off-limits and clearly not journalism. So saith the Washington Post's Lord High Emeritus Executive Editor, Leonard Downey Jr. He alleged that an organized, wide-scale political effort to intentionally humiliate journalists and others who work for the media outlets is something new. One wonders on what desert island he's been sojourning. The censorship, doxing, boycotts, and obstruction of revisionists, black nationalists, and conservative and Christian journalists doesn't seem to register or even exist for the media Brahmins of the upper crust. Follow the money. The legacy media will brook no competition that harms its lucrative monopoly on news. Therefore, we dissident journalists are supposed to know our place and be content with our lot as virtually invisible. The many attempts to humiliate, libel, obstruct and remove us from Google, YouTube, Facebook, Amazon, Twitter, and Instagram are of no concern to the high and mighty in the legacy press. And that's right, the various efforts over the last half dozen years, or particularly since Charlottesville, to deplatform white nationalists, Holocaust skeptics, and a whole lot of people in between, is outrageous and has garnered very little outrage from the mainstream media. This is what Downey writes. It's one thing for Spiro Agnew to call everyone in this press nattering nabobs of negativism, Mr. Downey said, referring to the late vice president's critique of how journalists covered President Nixon. And another thing to investigate individuals in order to embarrass them publicly and jeopardize their employment. Yeah, but that's what our lamestream media does. Michael Hoffman says, this is precisely what several corporate newspaper chains, cable television news, websites, blogs, and podcasts have been doing for years, including the New York Times, calling for the dismissal and loss of employment of alternative reporters who have been smeared as anti-Semitic, racist, sexist, homophobic, and so on. And I remember, this is some time ago, what happened to Joe Sobran when, for a couple of remarks, less than 110% supportive of Israel, he was hounded out of his job at National Review. A.G. Sulzberger, the publisher of the New York Times, said in a statement that exposure of shady biographical facts about Times reporters was a case of taking Trump's campaign against a free press to a new level. They are seeking to harass and embarrass anyone affiliated with the leading news organizations that are asking tough questions and bringing uncomfortable truths to light, Mr. Sulzberger declared. When such tactics are used against the leading news organizations, they are immoral and wrong. However, when the Times, Washington Post, and CNN smear, intimidate, and prevent alternative journalists who work for smaller online operations from asking tough questions and bringing uncomfortable truths to light, then it's not at all a matter for outrage. The news aristocrats have spoken. You may now kiss their designer shoes. Mr. Sulzberger takes the moral high ground on behalf of this very profitable and powerful business behemoth. Quote, the goal of this campaign is clearly to intimidate journalists from doing their job, which includes serving as a check on power and exposing wrongdoing when it occurs. The Times will not be intimidated or silenced. What about journalists who seek a check on your monopoly power and wrongdoing, Mr. Sulzberger? What if your newspapers endeavor to jeopardize our employment? This is Michael Hoffman II writing. Mr. Sulzberger's heresy-hunting New York Times has shown zero interest in defending conservative reporters who are not members of the legacy media from calumny and blacklisting. Often the Times has been guilty of these odious tactics themselves, which it now indignantly protests when its political rivals and business competitors employ them to deflate the reputation of the Times and inform the public concerning the questionable character of some of its writers and editors. In many cases, Sulzberger's newspaper has encouraged these attacks and covered up thought police groups like Right Wing Watch and Media Matters for America. These are anti-free speech groups that closely investigate and attack conservative journalists and sleeping giants, which is sworn to threaten and shame any platform online that dares to host radical alternatives to politically correct dogma and revolutionary social change. The Anti-Defamation League, or the ADL, is a prominent thought police group that campaigned for censorship of history books at Amazon, the silencing of black leaders like Minister Louis Farrakhan, and of activists who are outside the established boundary of permissible opinions about Israeli settler colonization and the racist creed of the Babylonian Talmud. Over the years, the New York Times has been a dependable mouthpiece for the ADL and complicit in its libel and intimidation. Yet the Times is horrified now that such tactics are being wielded against its own writers. Here we observe the grotesque hypocrisy of the entitled. And there's a DVD Lipstadt, Amalek, and Irving, a speech by Michael Hoffman, and I might play that at some point. In June, the Heresy Hunters at YouTube removed several legitimate revisionist history videos, together with many white nationalists and hate speech videos, or so they say. Having accepted without investigation Google's deceitful description of all the videos it removed from YouTube as constituting hate speech, the New York Times mechanically reported the entire ban in terms of taking down hate speech. Our video exposing Deborah Lipstadt's hate speech toward historian David Irving was one of the films banned from YouTube. Consequently, our video, which fulfilled a public service by advancing knowledge about the hate speech of an establishment revered Zionist celebrity, namely Deborah Lipstadt, was banned in the name of combating hate speech. You see, of course, this label, hate speech, is vacuous. It is undefinable. But hate speech is whatever the person making the accusation says it is. The Times cooperated and was party to the masquerade. Revisionist researchers and activists are barely human in the eyes of the Times and unworthy of the anguish and hand-wringing now being expended to defend their own hired hands from suppression and removal. This corrosive double standard undercuts Mr. Sulzberger's protestations and reveals the corruption at the heart of his newspaper's reporting. This is a piece by Michael Hoffman. And he says, below is the note we emailed to the two New York Times reporters who, in the August 25th online edition, told of the supposedly immoral and impudent move to investigate the background and statements of their distinguished fellow reporters at the Legacy Media's most honored and acclaimed flagship, to which every decent American is supposed to demonstrate fealty. Dear Messrs. Vogel and Peters, you wrote, in the case of the pro-Trump network, research into journalists is being deployed for the political benefit of the White House. And I would not agree with Michael Hoffman's sentiment here, but I can't abide Trump, but I consider these exposures of privileged members of the Legacy Media delightful, due to the fact that said media have acquiesced in massive censorship and denial of service on Facebook, YouTube, Google, and in Amazon censorship of historians' distant books. In these instances, involving alternative writers and journalists who compete with the New York Times and other legacy media, there's been little or no solidarity offered by your fellow reporters and editors. In many cases, where the harassed and interdicted alternative journalists are conservatives, there have been expressions from members of the legacy media satisfaction at the heresy hunting, doxing, and removals. Now, when the shoe's on the other foot, we're supposed to believe the process of sleuthing into journalists' public and private foibles and failings is somehow an outrage against press freedom. Freedom of the press does not begin at the gate of the legacy media. The Times, the Post, CNN, etc., were the ones who first let the genie out of the bottle. You ought to deal with the karmic consequences without whining. Better yet, work for the freedom of expression of your lumpen proletariat rivals online. Anyway, I thought that was a very well written piece by Michael Hoffman Jr. And I think this has to be said again and again and again. Free speech is very much in peril in the United States, and very much in peril, as we've seen here in Canada, by big businesses who are often the first in line for cheering on and suppressing free speech. And this is from the UNS Review. Pew Research Center confirms the Great Replacement. Great Replacement is happening. Since 2000, 109 U.S. counties have gone from majority white to majority non-white. And you can see this on a map. Many places in Texas, in Southern California, in Florida, in New Jersey, in Carolina. The Pew Research Center isn't so isolated far wide web site peddling conspiracy theories. Instead, this prestigious organization has all but confirmed the great replacement is remaking the United States of America. And this was an August 2019 study. It says, in the United States, the white share of the population is declining as Hispanic, Asian, and black populations grow. But the shift to a more diverse nation is happening more quickly in some places than in others. From 2000 to 2018, 109 counties in 22 states, from California to Kansas to North Carolina, went from majority white to majority non-white. That is, counties where non-Hispanic whites are no longer the majority, according to a Pew Research Center analysis of Census Bureau data. Our analysis includes only counties with a minimum population of 10,000 in 2018. These counties represent 77% of the nation's 3,142 counties and include 99% of the U.S. population. Overall, 293 U.S. counties are majority non-white in 2018. Most of the counties are concentrated in California, the South, and on the East Coast, with few in the country's middle section. In addition, several white counties with large populations may flip in coming years. Fairfax County, Virginia, with a population of 1.2 million, Pima County of Arizona with 1 million, Milwaukee County, Wisconsin with 948,000, and Cobb County, Georgia with 757,000, all had populations that were less than 52% white. In 21 of the 25 biggest U.S. counties by population, non-white groups together make up more than half of residents. Eight of these counties were majority white in 2000, but no longer. These include San Diego, Orange County, Riverside and Sacramento, all in California, Clark County in Nevada, Broward County in Florida, Tarrant County in Texas, and Wayne County in Michigan. Hispanics were the largest non-white population in all of these eight counties except Wayne, which contains Detroit, where the black population was the largest non-white group. In Broward County, Hispanic and black residents made up similar shares of the population at 30 and 28% respectively. As the nation's racial and ethnic diversity grows, whites remain the single largest racial or ethnic group in the U.S., while when looking at the country as a whole, accounting for 60% of all Americans. The four largest U.S. counties that had majority white populations in 2008 were Maricopa in Arizona, King in the state of Washington, Middlesex in Massachusetts, and Palm Beach in Florida. Another way to highlight the nation's changing demographics is to look at how many counties shifted the opposite way. From 2000 to 2018, just two counties went from minority white to majority white, Calhoun County in South Carolina and West Feliciana Parish in Louisiana, each with relatively small populations of about 15,000, which is tiny compared to some counties that we've already talked about with populations over 900,000. Among the 109 counties that between 2000 and 2018 shifted from majority white to majority non-white, 26 at least were 60% white in 2000. Counties in Georgia stand out for having 5 of the 10 biggest percentage point swings in their white population share. These 10 counties also had the largest percentage point drop among all U.S. counties on this measure. In less than 20 years, 109 counties across the United States felt the startling impact of the Great Replacement. Imagine what we'll see in 5 years. Demography is destiny. And that is the truth. And this is, of course, what drives the immigration reform movement. This must be stopped in its tracks. and eventually turned around. Or by 2041, you know, which is just 22 years from now, whites could be a minority. The European founding settler people could be a minority in the country they built. That's scary. But, and in terms of Canada, there will be a minority by 2050, but probably a bit before. Now, what is particularly galling is that in neither country was this massive population change ever debated or discussed. In neither Canada nor the United States were we given a choice, were we told, now look, now this is, in both countries, our immigration acts essentially changed in 1965. Coincidence? You think? And the legislation that maintained the White Australia policy changed the next year in 1966. You think there could be a connection? I think so, don't you? Of course. Anyway, in neither country, Canada nor the United States, was there a fair and open debate. In the United States, when the Immigration Act of 1924 was replaced by a new Immigration Act, one of its major supporters was a leftist New York Jew named Emanuel Seller. Another supporter was a very junior, then very junior, United States Senator, Edward Kennedy. And Kennedy was asked by some of the old perceptive members of the Senate, might this not involve a change in the makeup of the United States? Because instead of rigid quotas, double quota, a number, a quota to tie immigration to job requirements, and then a sub-quota, apportioning immigrants by region so as not to upset the ethnic balance, that all went out the window in favor of opening the doors. And some senators say, well, could, if there's a lot of immigration from the third world, which perhaps did not seem as likely in 1965 as it is today, you know, in the days just before easy, massive, cheap transatlantic flights. But still the question was asked, well, could this upset the ethnic balance? Oh, no, Kennedy said. No, absolutely not. No. Don't worry or your old gray heads about any such thing. Not going to happen. Well, might such immigration negatively affect American labor? No. Okay. Well, fast forward to about 10 years ago, when by this time it's painfully obvious that the demography of the United States is changing. And before he finally died of brain cancer, did Senator Kennedy ever go back on his policies? Did he ever say, you know, I think we got it wrong? No, to his dying day, he was a fanatical supporter of even more immigration and amnesty for illegals. No, the whole thing was bad faith. And we see that in Canada, too. We have never had an honest debate on where this is going. We were never told, look, we are going to change the rules in such a way that within 85 years, the European founding settler people of this country, you guys, will be a minority. How do you like them apples? Well, had this Kootenhove Kalergi replacement plan be honestly put to the Canadian or American people, of course it would have been voted down. I don't think a single member of parliament who put that to people would have been re-elected in 1965, and so they didn't. And what they have done very cleverly is, as people, dumb as they might be, begin to notice and say, geez, the neighborhood's changing. I feel like a stranger. And all kidding aside, I do. In places, a place I used to represent in North Rexdale. It's no longer white. It's East Indian and Jamaican. Lots of gangs up there, lots of shootings. I'm often put in mind of a rebel song from the so-called Troubles in Northern Ireland. And the sentiment, if not the exact words, capture what I feel. And the line from the sign, the town I loved so well, goes, and the armored cars and the bombed out bars in the town I loved so well. Immigration has devastated the area I grew up in. And third world immigration, the Europeans, the whites, are being replaced. Now, is that right? Well, we never had a chance to vote, to discuss it or vote on it. In fact, when you do mention it, when you mention immigration in as innocuous a way as saying cut immigration, that's billboards that were bought by supporters of Maxime Bernier's People's Party of Canada, they'd be quickly taken down by the corporate collaborationist company, in this case, Patterson Outdoor Signs. You're not even allowed to publicly discuss immigration critically, let alone a far more fundamental issue, not just the numbers. Yeah, they're too many, but the makeup. Why? Because it's the plan, and we're not supposed to talk about it. We're not supposed to criticize it. In fact, to kind of mess up your mind a little bit, if you are noticing this and maybe a little bit critical, our heads have been bombarded with a lot of empty slogans, like we need immigration to grow the economy. So, okay, you don't really like what's happening to your neighborhood, but don't forget, it's growing the economy, and you'll benefit from that too. Well, it's nonsense. Immigration in Canada costs net the Canadian taxpayer $40 billion a year. It doesn't grow the economy. It sucks off the economy. Another slogan, of course, which we hear on both sides of the border, diversity is our greatest strength. Oh, really? the diversity, that is, the bringing in large numbers of people with radically different values, backgrounds, and does not enrich us. It's not our greatest strength. It means constant compromise by the much put upon European founding settler majority. Here's an interesting story from the Friday National Post, and it tells us probe into an alleged neo-Nazi began in spring, General says. The military did not miss a Manitoba Army reservist's alleged links to a neo-Nazi group, but in fact first started looking into it months before media reports on the subject began to surface. Canada's top general said the other day, that's General, the Defense Chief General Jonathan Vance, was speaking out for the first time about Master Corporal Patrick Matthews, whose case has raised questions about whether the military is doing enough to address hate and right-wing extremism in the ranks. Vance issued a stern warning to those hoping to use the forces as a training ground or avenue. We are not a place for sick hobbyists to practice their vile ideology, and we won't stand for it. We will react, and where we can be proactive, we will be. But I assure you, we will react. This is the man, or I should say this is the general, who 2 summers ago, while our southern border was being invaded by illegals from the United States, pranced in Ottawa in the gay pride parade along with the trust fund kid, Justin Trudeau. Utterly failing to do what a military force ought to do, and that's to secure the borders. Oh no, he's too busy doing the latest politically correct gay pride thing. And listen to the arrogance. I don't know much about this Master Corporal Patrick Matthews. But the question is, what is the military doing to address hate and right-wing extremism? You mean, never, you, you know, let's be quite clear. Hate and right-wing extremism are basically meaningless terms. It means an ideology. It means holding to an ideology other than what's currently politically correct. That has no place in the Canadian Armed Forces. What? You mean people who may be sent overseas supposedly to defend democracy in godforsaken hellholes like Burkina Faso or Afghanistan, for heaven's sakes, aren't allowed freedom of political thought themselves in Canada? That there's a witch hunt against them? It's grotesque. As you say here, we are not a place for sick hobbyists to practice their vile ideology. You mean, well, you know, white supremacism is, of course, basically what they're talking about is pride in the white race, pride in being a European. So you can be homosexual and proud in the armed forces. In fact, you may even decide, although you came in with a penis, you want to go out without one and you want to have a sex change. Well, they'll pay for that. That's okay. But if you're proud of your own people who are European, you're some sort of vile, disgusting creature. Frankly, I would say to young Canadians, don't bother. That's their armed forces, not yours. As Otto von Bismarck once famously said about war in certain parts of the world, it's not worth the bones of a single Pomeranian grenadier. Let the minorities go and fight in peacekeeping and do that nonsense. If our views are not respected or wanted in the armed forces until things change, they're not worth our time and our effort. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. I'm going to take my musical break right now, and this is a historical night person I played last night. I hope you liked it. This is a very pretty singer-songwriter and performer, Becky Hobbs.
And this now is on stage, making her debut at Peterborough, the dynamic lady from Tulsa, singer-composer Becky Hobbs.
I'm going to do a little two-stepping song for y'all. I hope you've heard this before. This was a record out by me in the United States about 2 years ago. It's called Honky Tonk Saturday Night, and this is a Honky Tonk Sunday Night. Put on your cowboy hat and your faded blue jeans. Shine up them cowboy boots if it's where you wanna be. Show me to a bar with the fiddles feel good.
Becky Hobbs. And like her music, this is called Don't Call Me Becky Hobbs by Becky Hobbs.
Thank you all. I'd like to introduce you to my band, the Wild Hairs. We're from the United States of America, back here on the drums from Hartford, Connecticut. Like that. On the bass from Ruston, Louisiana, and vocals, Sean Cody.
Better stop dreaming.
Jazz, Don't Call Me. And here's another one by the Baxter Brothers X in Texas, Becky Hobbs. Once we get rid of the sad. Conclude this with one more song by Becky Hobbs, and this is one of her signature songs, Jones on the Jukebox, of course, after the late possum, George Jones. And this is actually not, we seem to have been booted off that one. Let's try this again. Jones on the Jukebox. Still trying to get this, Joan. Here we are, Jones on the Jukebox.
Crazy, a quarter at a time. He's got
And this is Paul Farmer. You're on the fighting side of me. Back with the game tomorrow. Same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever.